Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. We knew it then, and we know it now, 20 years later. The Dream Team, the 1992 USA men's basketball team that brought NBA superstars to the Olympics for the first time, is the greatest assemblage of talent in hoops history. It will never be topped, not in hype, not in skill, not in lore. The names on that Chuck Daly-coached roster read like a wing of the Hall of Fame in nearby Springfield. Jordan, Bird, Magic, Malone, Ewing, Barkley, Pippen. Even the last man off the bench, Christian Laettner, had been a champion at Duke and was the best college player in the country. What is easy to forget now is that the team's gold medal at the Barcelona Games was not always a certainty. Questions abounded about whether so many all-stars and egos could coexist. Would Michael Jordan even play? Did Larry Bird and a recently diagnosed HIV-positive Magic Johnson have anything left? Would players used to scoring 25 points and playing 40 minutes sit on the bench? Sports Illustrated senior writer Jack McCollum covered that team's initial run and caught up with the principals 2 decades later. He's the author of Dream Team, How Michael, Magic, Larry, Charles, and the Greatest Team of All Time Conquered the World and Changed the Game of Basketball Forever. Jack McCollum, welcome to the Roundtable.
Thanks for having me.
How did this team change the game of basketball?
Well, I think it, you know, we only came to realize this later, and I only came to realize it, honestly, when I started interviewing, even though from the beginning, that was sort of one of the subtitles of the book. So I said, well, I guess I better try to answer the question. And I think the way they changed it was, you know, was internationally, that we thought that all these 40 and 50 point defeats would kind of discourage the other nations, and all it would kind of be a grand applause-a-thon, you know, for the United States. And there was a little bit of that. But in other countries, something else was going on. You know, Dirk Nowitzki was 14 years old saying, hey, I see how this game is played. Yeah, those guys are 50 times better than me, but I keep working. You know, maybe they're 10 times better than me. Tony Parker was doing that in France. Manu Ginobili was doing that in Argentina. Haydu Turkoglu was doing that in Turkey. And all these guys, the world sort of opened up to them, the basketball world, and the game became demystified. Years later, the NBA has done surveys, it's not just me talking about this, that the number one thing in growing the international game and bringing international stars to the NBA was the Dream Team. It wasn't marketing, it wasn't clinics, it wasn't increased television exposure. All of those were a factor. The Dream Team was the number one factor.
When these guys have seen future iterations of the USA team start to lose, how do they take that now?
Well, I think they take it like everybody back then, you know, humanly would kind of take it. Hey, man, that would have never happened to us. And to a certain extent, yeah, okay, that's true. But I think the most honest of these guys, if you really ask them about it, would have to concede that it was different, that they were a great team. I think the greatest team of all time. But the competition was just not there. That you'd have, like, you know, Croatia, for example, was a terrific team. They had one NBA player, Drazen Petrovic. They had one young player, Tony Kukoc, who would become an NBA player in a few years. But, you know, now the United States is going to go up against Spain, let's say. You know, Spain's front court is bigger than the United States. It consists of two guys that are pretty good players in the NBA, Pau Gasol and Marc Gasol, both of those all-star caliber players. It's a different world, and I would hope in their most honest moments the Dream Team would consider that.
How much credit does the late Chuck Daly deserve for the team's success? I mean, it's easy to say this is a fantasy team. Anyone could go in there and coach, you know, 12 of the greatest players in the world and win these games. But there was a lot of pressure on him also. On the one hand, they couldn't lose. And on the other hand, he had to balance a lot of competing interests there.
No question. You know, Chuck was picked at a time when, I mean, think of the guys you had to choose from there. You had Pat Riley, who was not too many years removed from winning, you know, dominating the 80s with the Lakers team. You had Don Nelson, who was considered kind of an iconoclast with an eccentric, you know, way of strategizing. You had Larry Brown, you know, everybody's favorite be-everywhere coach. And Chuck's resume, it consisted of 2 NBA championships, but what it consisted of the most was this ability to get along with players. That didn't mean he was a wishy-washy guy, because I think that's the largest misconception about Chuck. Chuck's thing was, you got to give me 2 minutes out of every hour. 58 minutes, you can go where you want. You can drink. You can, you know, violate curfew, act like an ass. You give me these 2 minutes when you're a true professional. That's what I need out of you. And Chuck was smart enough to establish that, get out of the way, let the established veterans like Magic, Michael Jordan, and Larry Bird set the tone. And would another coach have won the gold medal? Let's be honest, probably. I mean, I don't know whether you or I would have, but probably another coach would have. But Chuck did it with the greatest amount of ease and diplomacy that it could possibly be done.
John Stockton is one of the great guards in the history of basketball. There's no question about it, and I don't think anyone would argue that his spot on the team wasn't earned. But Daly had to navigate the waters of adding his own star guard, Isaiah Thomas, and it's quite clear that Michael Jordan was not going to play with Isaiah. How did he balance that? He was the Pistons coach, that was his star, Isaiah wanted on, and ultimately he was left off this team.
I know that I never got a chance. Chuck died in 2009 before I did a full interview for him for the book. And that's sad that we lost him so early. But we talked, you know, over the years about it. And this was an extremely painful subject for Chuck Daly. And the direct answer to your question is Chuck dealt with it by saying, hey, I'm only the coach. The way this is structured is like an NBA team. The general manager gets the players. My job is to coach them. I didn't have anything to do with the selection committee, which is probably semantically true, but it's also a fact and has become clear from my research that Chuck really didn't go in and fight for Isaiah. And in retrospect, it would be interesting to find out what would have happened had Michael insisted on his demand that Isaiah not play, and that Chuck at the same time had insisted that Isaiah should be on the team based on merit. And I do not know how that would have come out, but it didn't play out that way because Chuck, for whatever reason, he felt that they needed Michael, did not fight that battle for his captain.
It's also interesting to look at what this meant to basketball in general. Nowadays, it's almost impossible to fathom that the NBA was not always on track to be a part of this. They weren't always happy with the idea of pros playing in the international game. It ended up being one of the great windfalls for the NBA that it's ever had, though.
Yeah, sure. And you know, people weren't happy then. I mean, the backing soundtrack to this whole thing was a general kind of baseline of discontent. What are we sending these guys over for? They're overwhelming the Olympics. Let's pay attention to the swimmers and gymnasts. These are the people that move the Olympics. Why are these guys living in a separate hotel? That was a fairly, within all the pornographic attention bestowed upon these guys, this was a backdrop to what was going on. And, you know, the NBA kind of, from a public relations standpoint, had to deal with that. And the Dream Team, you know, maybe a couple missteps. I mean, Charles Barkley elbowed an Ian Golan. But at the end of the day, maybe one of their most incredible things was they won all these games with some kind of dignity. And it sort of, they in other words, they were bullies without, you know, kind of acting like bullies. It set a kind of template for what was supposed to come later, and we were not able to live up to that. And in answer to your question, as the financial windfall continued, there's absolutely no doubt about it, the NBA derives about 10% of its $6 billion revenue from international markets, and that's without anybody playing a game. You know, there's not gate receipts. That started in 1992 and has continued apace right up to now.
I was thinking about hype while reading this book. I was a perfect age growing up to be completely enraptured by this team, and I think a lot of people share that. And it's one of those rare occasions in sports, and you are along for the ride, where the hype is actually true and should be true. And I was thinking about how this team would have existed today with Twitter and ESPN.com and every minute being followed. What do you remember most from that time covering this team, and how do you think that team would have played in a modern era?
Well, I think, you know, what you said about the social media was a great break for me, you know, doing the book, that the written record of these guys, the myth of these guys is overwhelming. But the written record of these guys, you know, in Barcelona's not really that large. I mean, there was not tweeting. There was not the internet. I mean, I didn't write. I only wrote three stories from Barcelona. I wrote for Sports Illustrated once a week. That's all I had. These days, my God, I would have been, you know, SI.com. I would have had 40-inch stories on there literally every day about this team. So it existed in kind of this fantasy land that you were able to delve into. And as far as how they would do now, I mean, my theory about players is always this, that the greatest players from any era would do well in any era. I mean, you look at Bill Russell in a black and white photo. Oh, my God, he wouldn't be that good. He wouldn't block all those shots. He would figure out a way to get it done. Elgin Baylor would figure out a way to get it done. Moving up, Jerry West would figure out a way to get it done. Walt Frazier, the greatest players. Well, this little subset of players, beside Christian Laettner, they were all great, great, great players. And they would have been able to play in any era. I don't know whether Michael Jordan would have been as dominant with LeBron James around. I mean, we'll never be able to answer that. But they would have been a force in any era at any time.
And when you were around the team at that moment, did you realize how special it was?
Well, you know, Chris Mullin told me something very interesting when I interviewed him, and he said that usually when you're in a moment, usually, particularly athletes, whose job it is to win a game, let's win on Tuesday night and we'll look ahead till Thursday's game on Wednesday night. He said even as they were in this moment, he realized how special it was. And he said it was our duty to play, and then he paused for a minute, and he said, ultimately, our duty to play ultimately. I thought that was really interesting and perspective, and we sort of saw that then. I did see this as something special. I remember taking my sons along to the qualifying tournament and just being so happy they were able to see this. However, having said that, the part we talked about earlier, I did not see all the ramifications. I wish I would have been the one to sit down and go, you know, 14, 10, 12 years from now, teams from France and Croatia are going to come into the league because of this model. I didn't see that. So in one respect, I saw part of the phenomenon, but I certainly did not see the whole picture.
We've been speaking with Sports Illustrated senior writer Jack McCollum. He's the author of Dream Team, How Michael, Magic, Larry, Charles, and the Greatest Team of All Time Conquered the World and Changed the Game of Basketball Forever. The book is published by Random House. Jack McCollum, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ian.
I don't know anything about Angola, but Angola's in trouble.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.